Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion of Naso, which goes from Numbers 4:21 through 7:89. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In Naso, Moses takes a census of the Levites who are to transport the pieces of the tabernacle and receives commands for investigating suspected cases of adultery and taking Nazirite vows, after which the 12 chiefs of Israel bring offerings for the dedication of the altar.
So this portion begins with God speaking to Moses, giving him more instructions for how to delegate the various duties of the tabernacle to the different Levite clans. We'd briefly covered in the previous portion that there are three clans of Levites, the sons of Kohath, the sons of Gershon, and the sons of Merari, with each clan having specific responsibilities for the tear down, transport, and setup of the various pieces of the Mishkan, or the tabernacle. In the last portion, we covered how the sons of Kohath were responsible for moving all the holy items in the Mishkan. They're responsible for taking that to where it needs to go. This portion then covers how the sons of Gershon are responsible for moving all the tapestries, all the fabrics that are involved in the tent and the surrounding wall of curtains for the outer courtyard, and also the covering for the tent of meeting and all that. And then for the clan of the sons of Merari, their responsibility is taking all of the boards and poles and sockets and bars and all of the like wooden and metal parts that actually make up the construction of the Mishkan, including the pillars for the outer court. The priests are responsible for overseeing all of the Levites, the priests being Aaron and his sons, them also being Levites. But specifically, Aaron's son Eleazar is responsible for overseeing the Kohathites as they're moving all of the holy things. And Ithamar, Aaron's other son, is responsible for overseeing the sons of Merari and the sons of Gershon as they do their duties.
So at this point, Moses and Aaron take a census of all the working age Levites, which means all the Levites from 30 years old to 50 years old. And they're the ones who are going to be doing the work of carrying the holy things and the parts of the tabernacle. And in total, this accounts for 8,580 Levites. So they literally have thousands of Levites to do this work of carrying the tabernacle. And it's the job of Aaron's two sons to direct all these thousands of Levites in doing this work.
So like we said, here, Moses is numbering all the different Levite clans from ages 30 to 50, because that's the age where they can work for carrying the Mishkan, the tabernacle. So I wanted to bring up another passage from 1 Chronicles, which happens at the end of David's life, after he's brought the Mishkan to Jerusalem, and he's preparing for his son Solomon to build the temple. And it says that before he died, he gathered all the Levites and counted them from 30 years old and upward. And whereas in the book of Numbers, when they counted from 30 to 50, it was only 8,000-something men. Here in 1 Chronicles, it says that they counted 38,000 Levites. So that's a ton more Levites, and it just shows that after those hundreds of years from the Mishkan there to David getting ready for the temple to be built, Israel had really grown a lot, and God had really blessed the people of Israel. Now, what's really interesting here is that after he numbers them all 30 years old and upward, it says that David then numbered them 20 years old and upward. For David said, "Adonai, God of Israel, has given rest to his people, and he dwells in Jerusalem forever. Also, the Levites will no longer need to carry the tabernacle and all its utensils for its service. For by the last words of David, the sons of Levi were numbered from 20 years old and upward." So one of David's last decrees, if not his very last decree, was to change the counting system from 30 years old and up to 20 years old and up, specifically because the Levites won't need to carry the Mishkan around anymore. David's whole reasoning behind changing from a Mishkan setup to a temple setup was because he felt like it was unfair for God to still be living in a tent while the rest of the people of Israel were living in houses and were really firmly established in the land of Israel. And so even though God never commanded, "Build me a permanent house," David really wanted to do that, and God blessed David in doing that. He said, "David, you yourself won't build it, but your son Solomon will." And so we see that with the establishing of the temple, things changed a little bit. The temple was established because God had given rest to his people Israel, and we're seeing that with the establishment of the temple, there's also going to be rest given to the sons of Levi. They aren't going to be carrying stuff around anymore, and as such, they can count them from 20 years old and up.
Now, even though the Levites weren't moving the tabernacle anymore, that doesn't mean they were completely out of a job. David gave them new jobs in line with the new house for God. Some of them were appointed as gatekeepers, and they were given jobs to assist the sons of Aaron with caring for the courts and chambers of the temple, and for cleansing the things that are holy and any work in the service of the house of God. Not to mention singing praises to God with instruments every day in the temple. So next, God talks to Moses about a situation where a man suspects that his wife has committed adultery, but he can't prove it, and she wasn't actually caught in the act. So if this man is feeling jealous about his wife, even though he doesn't know whether or not she's actually cheated, he brings his wife to the tent of meeting, and he also brings a grain offering. It's specifically a grain offering of jealousy and a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance. This is a grain offering specifically for the purpose of remembering if this person did something wrong. And so when the priest is presented with this situation and this offering, he then conducts a pretty weird test to see whether or not the woman has actually committed adultery. So the priest puts the grain offering of remembrance in the hands of the woman. And then he takes holy water and dust from the ground of the tabernacle, and he mixes it to make the water of bitterness that brings the curse. And it's called the water of bitterness that brings the curse because it's bitter and it brings a curse to the person who drinks it. And he actually, the priest is supposed to make the woman swear an oath that when she drinks this water, if she has committed adultery, then God will make her thigh fall away and her womb swell, and the water will cause bitter pain. But if the woman is innocent, then she'll be free from the curse. So after the priest has said all these curses and the woman has sworn an oath about these curses, the priest then writes the curses down in a book and washes them off into the water of bitterness that brings the curse. So now this water of bitterness is cursed flavored. And at this point, the priest takes the grain offering out of the hands of the woman and burns a memorial portion of it on the altar. And then he has the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse. And so, of course, if she had indeed committed adultery, then at this point, the curse comes. It causes bitter pain, and then her thigh falls off and her womb swells.
Oy vey.
And she herself then becomes a curse among her people. But interestingly, it says, on the other hand, if she is clean and innocent, then she shall be free and also shall conceive children. So this is just a really interesting test overall. Because when there's no witnesses, there's no way to prove whether or not this woman has committed adultery, God himself will step in for the people of Israel. I think this shows how seriously God takes the commitment between a man and his wife, to the point that if the woman breaks this commitment, then God will punish her in this terrible way. And this shows that even when you think there's no one watching and you think you can get away with sin, there's always someone watching. Yeah. And God knows what you've done, and God is willing to punish.
It reminds me of what it says at the end of Ecclesiastes, "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil." God is the ultimate judge of everything we do and say. And he sees everything we do and say, and so that should put a proper fear of God into us.
David says in Psalm 139, "O Adonai, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Adonai, you know it altogether. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day. For darkness is as light with you. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." So David is saying, God knows everything about us. He knows everything we do. He knows everything we think. Even before we say something, he knows what we're thinking. And there's no way to hide from that. In John, it also says, "Everyone who is doing wicked things hates the light and does not enter into it so that his actions may not be detected. But he who is doing the truth comes to the light so that his actions may be revealed that they are having been done in God." So wicked people try to hide from God, and they think they can do that in the darkness. But God sees in the dark. It's as light to him. And so instead, our response should be to come to the light, to have the same attitude as David, to call upon God to search our hearts and to test us. And so if we're open to that searching, instead of trying to hide from him and failing, if we come to him and welcome his presence, then he can lead us in the way we should go. And if we're constantly coming to God's light, inviting him to search us, then we're revealing that we are in God, that we are not hiding things, that we don't need to hide because what we are doing and thinking and our heart condition is right.
So after this, God then moves on to discuss what's called taking a Nazarite vow. What this means is that the person will choose to become a Nazarite, which means someone separated, who will dedicate himself to God and bring on extra rules for himself during the entire period that he says, "I'm going to be a Nazarite now." The main restrictions on a Nazarite are that he's not allowed to eat or touch or drink any grapes or grape products. He's not allowed to be near dead human bodies, and he's also not allowed to cut his hair.
And it also says that until the time is completed for which the Nazarite separates himself to Adonai, he shall be holy. So by separating himself with this vow, he's agreeing for a certain period of time to be more holy for God. That's what being holy means, is to be set apart, separate. And so he's vowing this specific time of holiness and separation for God.
So the rules for a Nazarite are basically that they have to abstain from those three things: dead bodies, grapes, and cutting their hairs. And it basically says that if a Nazarite is with someone and that person just drops dead, then the Nazarite has violated his vow and he needs to be purified and start over his Nazarite vow. For 7 days, he'll be unclean, and then on the 8th day, he'll have to cut off all of his hair, so start over, and he'll have to bring offerings to atone for himself. And then the portion also says that when you finish a Nazarite vow, not when it's broken, but when you actually finish it, you have to go to the priest, you give your offerings, and then you shave your hair. But basically, when you're a Nazarite, all the hair on your head is holy. Your head is dedicated to God. And so over the length of time that you're separate and dedicated to God, the growth of your hair, all of that belongs to God. Now, Nazarites aren't mentioned very often in the Bible. It's only a few times that we actually hear about them. One of the most famous examples being Samson. An angel of God appeared to Samson's parents before he was born and said that Samson would be a Nazarite his whole life. So his whole life he couldn't eat grapes or cut his hair or go near dead things or anything like that. He was separate and holy to God, and God was going to use him to judge Israel and save Israel from their enemies. Now, interestingly, Samson was well known for killing Philistines, so he would have been around dead Philistines quite often, so I'm not 100% sure how that would work. But whatever the case, Samson was a Nazarite, and he was dedicated to God. And that's why Samson's God-given strength left Samson when Delilah cut his hair. His hair was holy to God, and that was basically the mark of his Nazarite vow. And once his hair was cut, his vow was over, his strength was gone. Now, the book of Acts seems to include another example of a Nazarite vow with the emissary Paul. In Acts 18:18, it says that Paul shaved his head because he had taken a vow. And then later in Acts 21, it says that he was purified with some other people who had taken a vow, and they shaved their heads and offered offerings in the temple. The entire description seems to match what Numbers is describing here as a Nazarite vow. And as we discussed in a previous portion, the reason why Paul purified himself with these other Jews to do these offerings in the temple was to show that he was still a faithful Jew who was following the Torah of Moses, and that he wasn't teaching other Jewish believers to abandon Moses.
The vow of the Nazarite is completely voluntary. But once you take that vow, you are committing yourself to a greater degree of holiness. And so if you then violate those standards of the Nazarite after having taken the vow, then you've defiled your consecrated head. And so God actually says a sin offering and a guilt offering for atonement are necessary because he sinned by reason of the dead body. So taking the vow is optional. But once you've taken the vow, violating the vow is a sin. So if you make a commitment, if you make a vow, you are then required to hold to the conditions of that vow. You can't change it, or you're sinning. Yeshua actually extended this concept when he said, "You heard that it was said to the ancients, you must not swear falsely, but you will pay your oaths to Adonai. But I say to you not to swear at all, but let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. And anything which is more than these is of the evil." So Yeshua is saying, on the one hand, that it's better not to swear at all than to swear an oath falsely and to not fulfill your oath. Because, like we just said, if you take a vow and then you don't fulfill it, that's a sin. So it's better to just not swear at all. But on top of this, Yeshua is also saying to let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Yaakov also says in similar terms to let your yes be yes and your no be no. So I think what's also trying to be indicated here is that you shouldn't need oaths to be a man of your word. If you're going to do something, you should just be able to say, yes, I'm going to do that, and that should be sufficient, which then implies that you need to be a man of your word. Even if you're not taking a vow, everything you say should be reliable. So Yeshua is calling us to a higher standard. If it's sinful to violate our word when we've taken a vow, then we should also try not to violate our word whenever we say anything.
So after finishing discussing Nazarite vows, the portion then goes on to give the Aaronic benediction. This is a really famous portion of scripture, and God is saying Aaron and his sons, the priests, are responsible for giving this blessing over the people of Israel. The blessing is, "May Adonai bless you and keep you. May Adonai make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Adonai lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." So this is just a really awesome blessing, very simple but very powerful. And it's just blessing the people of Israel and saying, "May God be with you and bless you." Interestingly, it says, "So they shall invoke my name," or the Hebrew is "put my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them." So the priests, as God's holy people who are responsible for mediating between God and the people, they are here putting God's name onto the whole people of Israel. And in that way, God will then bless the people. When God's holy priests are putting God's name on the people of Israel, then that's setting them apart to be his. And what's interesting is that God is telling Aaron and his sons to bless the people of Israel. And in doing so, God will bless the people of Israel. So it's like this twofold blessing. Aaron is blessing Israel with God's blessings.
So next we read that the 12 chiefs of the tribes of Israel, so these were the leaders we talked about in the previous portion who had assisted Moses and Aaron with the census, each of these chiefs now comes to bring offerings before God. And first they bring 6 wagons with 12 oxen, so 2 oxen per wagon and a wagon per 2 chiefs. Now it turns out these wagons can actually be very useful. Because God tells Moses, give these wagons to the Levites to help them with their work of moving the tabernacle. Now, as we said before, there are 3 clans of Levites. The sons of Kohath moved the holy things, the sons of Gershon moved the tapestries, and the sons of Merari moved the frames and bases. So Moses gives 2 of the 6 wagons to the sons of Gershon to load up all the fabrics and whatnot. And he gives the other 4 carts to the sons of Merari to carry the heavier stuff. But it explicitly says that to the sons of Kohath he gave none, because they were charged with the service of the holy things that had to be carried on the shoulder. Most of the holiest things had poles specifically made for the purpose of transportation. And these things have to be moved exactly the way God prescribed, with the poles on the shoulders by the sons of Kohath. As we talked about in the previous portion, when David tried to move the ark into Jerusalem without having the sons of Kohath there to carry the ark on their shoulders, and they instead tried carrying it on a cart pulled by oxen, the result was that someone ended up dying. Mm. And so Moses is specifically enumerating right here, wagons are not for transportation of those things, but they can be very helpful when carrying all the wooden and metal bases and frames for the huge tabernacle.
So after the 12 chiefs give the oxen and carts to the sons of Levi, they then bring other offerings. They each have a really big offering that they want to give. And so for each day in a row, for 12 days, each chief brings his offering. This next part is a really riveting read where it just says the exact offering that each chief gave each day. And for each of the 12 chiefs, it's exactly the same. Exactly every single animal that they gave and all the grain, and that it was in gold bowls and in silver platters. And it says it over and over and over again, basically copying almost exactly 12 different times.
In total, this amounts to 2,400 shekels of silver, 120 shekels of gold, 12 bulls of burnt offerings, 12 rams of burnt offerings, 12 lambs of burnt offerings, with their grain offerings, 12 goats of sin offerings, and for peace offerings, 24 bulls, 60 rams, 60 goats, and 60 lambs. So combined, this is a huge offering. So this is the chiefs of Israel really giving the best of what Israel has to offer, and it's a lot. It beats all the offerings we've seen and all the offerings we'll see until like the time of Solomon.
And finally, this portion wraps up by describing how Moses would go into the tent of meeting to speak with God. It's only one verse right at the end of the portion, and it says, "Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, to speak with God, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat, or the kaporet, that is on the ark of the testimony, from between the two cherubim. So he spoke to him." So this is parallel to something that we read back in Exodus, when before the Mishkan had even been built, Moses had set up a tent and called it the tent of meeting. And it says that Moses went into the tent of meeting and he would speak to God face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Basically, Moses is doing the same thing here in the Mishkan, in the tent of meeting, going into the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant is and speaking to God, and God speaking back, an audible voice just talking back and forth. And like we had said in a previous portion, no one else is really allowed to go into the Holy of Holies except the high priest, and even he's not allowed to go in more than once a year on the Day of Atonement. So this is again showing how special Moses is and that really close connection that we've seen a lot, especially in the book of Exodus. And what else is really crazy about this is that we had seen early on in the book of Exodus, Moses would go up onto Mount Sinai where there was thunder and smoke and fire and rumblings, and it was a terrifying sight and none of the people could go near the mountain. But now Moses speaks to God in the Mishkan right in the center of the camp of Israel. He gets the commands of God right there in the middle of the people. This is what God had promised to do. He had promised to make his dwelling place, his Mishkan, with the people of Israel. So now instead of being up there on a mountain far from the people, he is down here in the midst of his holy people, Israel.
I think the big takeaway from this portion is that we should commit to serving God and follow through on that commitment. Like the Nazarites, who took a vow because they wanted to be holy for God, we who are holy to God should strive to commit to being holy for him and serving him. As followers of Messiah, it is our duty to serve him. And so we should always be faithful in pursuing that calling. But we also see that God takes commitments very seriously. When a Nazarite takes a vow, he expects that person to hold to that vow. And also with the marriage covenant, God was willing to enforce that through bitter, painful punishment of those who broke faith with that commitment to their spouse. So if we are truly committed to serving our Master Yeshua, we should take that very seriously. We should do everything in our power to constantly maintain that. Because even when nobody's watching and we think we can get away with things, God is always watching and he always sees, he knows our deepest thoughts even before we do. So we should always be coming to God, pursuing his light so that he can lead us in the way of everlasting life so we can follow through on our commitment to serve God always.
That wraps up the portion of Naso. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Baha'alotcha, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.